cases that challenge you in the emergency department are those you can expect to encounter during the oral board exam. This may make you feel a little uncomfortable at first, particularly since you will be meeting this challenge in front of your peers. However, the review that follows will sharpen your clinical acuity in managing these difficult cases. And like many of us who have passed this exam, you will find it beneficial to your clinical practice as well. In this session, I'm going to enumerate the major categories that deserve special attention in preparation for this exam, and I'm going to talk about the challenges you'll face in managing them. I have also included the case management checklist found in the oral board book on pages 151 through 154. Because of its importance in managing difficult cases, I have repeated it here and added comments. There are 9 major categories of cases that pose special problems to the oral board candidate. Here they are. 1. Major trauma that involves multiple injuries. 2. Cardiopulmonary emergencies at high risk for cardiac arrest. 3. Substance abuse with complicating illnesses or injuries. 4. Poisoning and overdose. 5. Pediatric emergencies. 6. Acid-base disorders. 7. Environmental emergencies. 8. Vascular emergencies. And 9. Diabetic emergencies. In my judgment, these 9 represent the core case categories of the oral exam. Now let's go back through these categories and determine the critical decision points that can make or break a clinical performance. The first category is major trauma that involves multiple injuries. The critical decision points in advanced trauma life support are the following. 1. Choosing appropriate airway control measures while establishing and maintaining inline cervical spine immobilization. 2. The timing of chest tube insertion once the diagnosis of pneumothorax has been established clinically. 3. Determining the size and placement of IV catheters. 4. Choosing appropriate methods for gastric emptying and bladder decompression. And 5. Determining the need for peritoneal lavage, abdominal CT, or focused abdominal ultrasonography for trauma, the FAST exam. The first 3 critical decision points revolve around the ABCs. Let's begin with the airway. Deciding which airway control measure is indicated in a given patient is the first challenge in managing the severely traumatized patient, and it is the most crucial. An error in judgment here can lead to dire consequences. Before taking definitive steps, however, be sure the cervical spine is adequately immobilized. This includes a backboard, a semi-rigid stiff neck collar and sandbags or similar bolstering device, with chin and forehead straps anchored to the backboard. For the patient with airway compromise or one with an altered level of consciousness, intubation is indicated. If the patient is not deeply unconscious, rapid sequence induction may also be required. The majority of RSIs can be safely and effectively performed with a combination of etomidate and succinylcholine. Other agents can be used, of course, but the literature still supports the use of these combined agents for most situations. A notable exception is infants and children, where the one proven pretreatment measure is atropine, 0.02 mg per kilogram, since succinylcholine can produce a profound bradycardia and possibly asystole. In any case, adequate preoxygenation is the first step. If the patient has spontaneous respirations, apply a non-rebreather with high-flow oxygen. If respirations are inadequate, the patient needs to be bag valve masked with 100% oxygen. This should be followed by the induction agent, etomidate, or in kids, pretreatment with atropine. 15 to 30 seconds later, the paralytic agent, succinylcholine, can be given. If you are unable to intubate the patient as described above, a surgical airway is indicated unless you are skilled in rescue airway management with the intubating laryngeal mask airway or combitube. If one of these procedures cannot be performed quickly and easily, surgical cricothyroidotomy is the procedure of choice in adults, and needle cricothyroidotomy is the preferred procedure in children less than 12 years old. Next is breathing. When you suspect a pneumothorax on clinical grounds, should you wait for X-ray confirmation prior to chest tube thoracostomy? Well, here's a guideline that should help you make that decision. If there is evidence of tension, or if the patient is in obvious respiratory distress, or if the breath sounds are significantly decreased or absent on one side, insert a large bore catheter into the second intercostal space above the rib at the midclavicular line and follow with chest tube decompression. Then order an X-ray to confirm tube placement, as well as re-expansion of the lung. Next is circulation. The size and placement of IV catheters in the severely traumatized patient is a critical decision since the estimated blood and fluid loss is frequently underestimated. Two large bore peripheral catheters, 14 to 16 gauge, should be inserted in all patients in whom the potential for hypovolemic shock exists. A central line may subsequently be inserted to help guide fluid resuscitation, but should not be used as a primary IV fluid resuscitation route unless peripheral access is not possible. Next is gastric and bladder decompression. Gastric emptying to prevent aspiration and determine the presence of blood is usually accomplished with a nasogastric tube. There can be no objection to that with most patients, but those with facial or basilar skull fractures should have orogastric tubes. In this group of patients, nasogastric tubes can penetrate the cranial vault if the cribriform plate has been injured. Foley catheterization is usually required in patients with multiple injuries if they cannot void spontaneously. This is contraindicated, however, in patients with suspected urethral injury, that is, those with blood at the urethral meatus, scrotal hematoma, or a high-riding or boggy prostate. Therefore, a rectal exam and an exam of the urethral meatus and scrotum should always precede Foley insertion in multiple trauma patients. If urethral injury is suspected, a retrograde urethrogram should be done to rule out this diagnosis. In the male, urethral rupture should alert the clinician to possible associated pelvic fractures. In the female, urethral injury in the presence of pelvic fractures is also associated with vaginal rupture. A question I have been frequently asked is this: don't patients with urethral tears require bladder decompression? Well, yes, they do. But if the bladder is not distended, suprapubic catheterization is done by the urologist in the OR at the time of the urethral repair. However, if the bladder is found to be distended while the patient is in the emergency department, suprapubic catheterization should be done there, either by you or the urologist. This can be accomplished with a percutaneous cystotomy set or a peritoneal dialysis trocar and catheter. Next is abdominal injury. Peritoneal lavage, CT, or ultrasonography are procedures that may be overlooked in the din of activity surrounding a seriously injured patient. If circumstances dictate the need to confirm or rule out a surgical abdomen in the multiple trauma patient with an unreliable abdominal exam, and a history or physical findings which suggest the possibility of an intra-abdominal injury, one of these procedures needs to be done. Specific indications include head or spinal cord injuries, an altered level of consciousness due to drug or alcohol abuse, a history of blunt abdominal trauma in a patient with unexplained hypotension, a negative exam in a patient who has sustained blunt abdominal trauma and who will be unavailable for sequential exams, and an equivocal or unreliable exam in a patient with multiple injuries. For the hemodynamically unstable patient, the procedure of choice is peritoneal lavage because it is readily available, can be rapidly performed, and most of all, has a sensitivity of 98%. The major pitfalls of DPL are that it can miss significant retroperitoneal bleeding and isolated hollow viscous perforation. The single most useful test for evaluating retroperitoneal organs, that is, the kidney, colon, and pancreas, is CT with contrast. However, it misses some injuries of the bowel and pancreas, as well as the diaphragm and bladder. In addition, the use of CT is reserved for the hemodynamically stable patient. An alternative to DPL and CT for evaluating both hemodynamically stable and unstable patients with blunt abdominal trauma is ultrasonography. The major disadvantage of this procedure is that it can miss bowel and retroperitoneal injuries. Also, a negative or equivalent ultrasound does not rule out the need for further testing. The second major category of cases is cardiopulmonary emergencies at high risk for cardiopulmonary arrest. Examples of such cases include the following: the acute MI, the acute MI with AV block, the acute MI with cardiogenic shock, supraventricular tachycardia with shock, ventricular tachydysrhythmias, and pulmonary edema in the absence of an MI. If you get one of these cases, or a similar one, you'll get the feeling that he's going to arrest, and he usually does. Critical decision points in these cases can be divided into two groups: those that occur before the arrest, and those that occur at the time of arrest. Right now, let's look at these patients before the arrest. The patient with an obvious or apparent acute MI should be stabilized immediately with an IV, O2, pulse oximeter, and cardiac monitor. Chest pain should be treated with nitroglycerin. Morphine is indicated for continuing pain that is unresponsive to nitroglycerin and other anti-ischemic agents, as well as antiplatelet agents. Those patients who meet criteria for thrombolytic agents and have no known contraindications should receive one of them as quickly as possible, preferably within 30 minutes of arrival in the emergency department. Aspirin should be given immediately unless contraindications exist. Adjuvant therapy with IV heparin, beta blockers, glycoprotein 2B3A receptor inhibitors, and ACE inhibitors should also be initiated when appropriate. New onset ventricular ectopy that occurs in association with an acute MI that is frequent, repetitive, and associated with circulatory compromise should be treated. In the patient with an uncomplicated MI, lidocaine may be used. For a complicated MI, one with pump dysfunction, amiodarone is a better choice. The appropriate intervention sequence for symptomatic bradycardia that occurs in association with an acute MI is atropine or transcutaneous pacing. Initial treatment with atropine is indicated only when serious signs and symptoms are occurring with a heart rate greater than 50 in a patient who has an IV in place or when a transcutaneous pacer is not immediately available. Hemodynamically unstable bradycardia, that is, a rate less than 50, is a clear indication for placement of transcutaneous patches with provision for immediate pacing. The patient with an acute MI and AV block is at high risk for ventricular asystole. Do not give this patient lidocaine or procainamide, since either of these drugs may suppress his normally functioning rhythm. Bertillium should not be given either, and it has been removed from the ACLS guidelines because of a high occurrence of side effects and the limited supply and availability of the drug. In the presence of an advanced block, that is, Mobitz 2 or a wide complex third-degree AV block, a transvenous pacemaker should be inserted, even if the patient is asymptomatic. While preparations for insertion of a transvenous pacemaker are being made, symptomatic patients should be temporized with a transcutaneous pacemaker. Atropine should be avoided in these patients because it decreases the proportion of beats conducted in infranodal block. Atropine works best in nodal block, that's first degree, Mobitz 1, and narrow complex third degree AV block, by shortening the PR interval and/or increasing the proportion of conducted beats. The patient in cardiogenic shock secondary to an acute MI requires aggressive management. Ideally, Swan-Ganz catheterization should be done to guide therapy, but only if the time, equipment, and expertise are available. The board will probably not require you to perform the procedure yourself, but you should know the indications for emergency Swan-Ganz catheterization. In any case, the patient in cardiogenic shock should be intubated early to ensure adequate ventilation and oxygenation. The goals of therapy in the treatment of cardiogenic shock are reduction of pulmonary congestion and increased cardiac output. These goals are achieved by the use of agents that reduce preload and afterload, inotropic agents, and vasopressors. Assuming that Swan-Ganz catheterization is not done, the choice of drugs is dictated by the patient's systolic blood pressure. If the patient's blood pressure is greater than 100 millimeters mercury, use agents that reduce preload and afterload and provide inotropic support. IV nitrates such as nitroglycerin and sodium nitroprusside produce the most predictable reduction in preload. In addition, both drugs decrease the afterload and help to increase cardiac output. In the setting of an acute MI, IV nitroglycerin is especially useful because it also alleviates pain and reduces myocardial ischemia. However, it should be avoided in the presence of bradycardia or extreme tachycardia. The dose of IV nitroglycerin is 10 to 20 micrograms per minute. The dose of IV nitroprusside is 5 to 10 micrograms per minute every 5 to 10 minutes until a favorable response occurs. A further increase in cardiac output can be achieved with inotropic agents such as dopamine or dobutamine. The dose of both dopamine and dobutamine is 5 to 20 micrograms per kilogram per minute. Now let's talk about those patients whose systolic blood pressure is between 70 and 100 millimeters mercury. What these patients need is inotropic support. Use dopamine, dobutamine, or both. Agents that reduce preload can be used in combination with these inotropes, but in reduced dosages. Finally, let's consider the patient whose systolic blood pressure is less than 70, or those who have not responded to pharmacologic therapy so far. These patients are obviously in real trouble. Chances are that at least 40% of the myocardium has been damaged, and cardiac arrest is imminent. Try a norepinephrine drip, 4 milligrams in 250 cc's D5W. The initial infusion rate is 0.5 to 1 microgram per minute, which can be titrated to a maximum dose of 30 micrograms per minute. When the systolic blood pressure rises to 80 millimeters mercury, try dopamine. Start the infusion at 5 micrograms per kilogram per minute, and titrate up to 20 micrograms per kilogram per minute as needed. When the systolic pressure reaches 90 millimeters mercury, add dobutamine to reduce the requirement for dopamine. For those patients in cardiogenic shock accompanied by severe pulmonary edema unresponsive to diuretics, vasodilators, and conventional inotropic agents, consider the administration of amrinone, which has similar hemodynamic properties to those of dobutamine. Like dobutamine, it improves myocardial contractility through its positive inotropic action, but it also has a direct vasodilatory effect, which makes it a very potent agent. So potent, in fact, that it may even be cardiotoxic. However, if nothing else has worked and the patient's clinical condition is running a downhill course, it's worth a try. The dose is 0.75 milligrams per kilogram IV over 2 to 3 minutes, followed by an infusion of 5 to 15 micrograms per kilogram per minute. An additional bolus may be given in 30 minutes. An amrinone infusion requires hemodynamic monitoring to titrate the dose properly, because hemodynamic improvement is not necessarily associated with changes in heart rate or blood pressure. For patients with atrial fibrillation of acute onset, that's less than 48 hours, and hypotension, rate control is probably best achieved with amiodarone, particularly if there is any question of an underlying Wolff-Parkinson-White syndrome. DC cardioversion may also be required to convert the rhythm. In patients with cardiogenic shock secondary to an acute MI, Keep in mind the possibility of mechanical lesions which may predispose the patient to shock. These include mitral regurgitation secondary to rupture of the papillary muscle, ventricular septal rupture, and left ventricular aneurysm formation. Aortic balloon counterpulsation may be useful in these cases. Early surgical consultation is mandated if a mechanical lesion is suspected. The next case, supraventricular tachycardia with shock, requires immediate synchronized cardioversion. The initial dose is 50 joules. Most patients respond to a low dose, but if initial cardioversion is unsuccessful, increase the voltage to 100 joules and try again. If there is still no response, the energy level can be increased to 200 joules before making a third attempt. Ventricular tachydysrhythmias should be treated according to ACLS protocols. These are reviewed on the 6th CD. Cardiogenic pulmonary edema in the absence of an MI, in my opinion, is a unique challenge in every case, since the response to therapy varies from patient to patient. I believe this is due to several factors, including age, general physical condition, previous cardiac history, and medications the patient is taking. A major critical decision point in these patients is reached if the patient is not responding well to a high oxygen concentration, IV nitrates, and an adequate Lasix dose, 1 mg per kilogram. Continued administration of these agents is not likely to work. At this point, you have to consider possible causes of the patient's failure to respond to conventional therapy. These include paroxysmal atrial fibrillation, systemic arterial hypertension, acute bronchospasm, also known as cardiac asthma, respiratory acidosis, metabolic acidosis, and anemia. Paroxysmal atrial fibrillation is treated initially by controlling the ventricular rate. The drug of choice in the absence of hypotension is diltiazem. Once the ventricular rate is slowed, chemical conversion with amiodarone can usually be achieved. However, if the patient's clinical condition is seriously compromised, consider DC cardioversion. The dose of diltiazem is 0.25 mg per kilogram, IV over 2 minutes, followed in 15 minutes by a second bolus of 0.35 mg per kilogram if the first bolus was tolerated but ineffective. IV amiodarone is administered as 150 mg over 10 minutes, followed by a 1 mg per minute infusion for 6 hours, and then 0.5 mg per minute. Note that the role of amiodarone in the treatment of atrial fibrillation is different in the setting of left ventricular dysfunction with hypotension and without hypotension. Amiodarone is the agent of choice in the patient with pulmonary edema and cardiogenic shock in controlling the ventricular rate. But in the patient with atrial fib and pulmonary edema without shock, diltiazem is the drug of choice to slow the ventricular rate, with amiodarone being used in this setting to convert the rhythm. This is an important distinction for you to understand. Systemic arterial hypertension is best treated with IV nitroglycerin, since it acts rapidly to reduce preload. Sometimes this is all that is needed. However, if the blood pressure remains elevated, switch to nitroprusside, which is a stronger agent. Patients with respiratory acidosis unresponsive to high oxygen concentrations should be intubated and continued on high oxygen concentrations. Ventilatory assistance with the use of continuous positive airway pressure, or CPAP, can improve oxygenation, and it can also reduce preload by inhibiting venous return. If the patient also has severe metabolic acidosis, that is, an arterial pH less than 7.1, despite correction of respiratory acidosis, sodium bicarbonate can be given as well. Administer half the calculated deficit and then repeat the ABGs to determine the efficacy of therapy and the need for any additional bicarb. The patient found to have significant anemia, which may have precipitated pump failure, should be treated with slow infusion of packed red cells. For the patient in pulmonary edema with shock, follow the treatment guidelines discussed in the section on cardiogenic shock secondary to an acute MI. Now I want to talk briefly about cardiopulmonary patients who arrest during the course of treatment. For the purposes of the exam, the arrest is likely to be witnessed, either by you, a nurse, or an EMT. Critical points to remember are these. 1. Patients with witnessed ventricular fibrillation who do not convert with a single defibrillation attempt require immediate CPR, beginning with chest compressions and intubation, and then followed by epinephrine IV or endotracheally if an IV is not in place, prior to further defibrillation attempts. Check the rhythm again after 5 cycles of CPR or after 2 minutes have passed. Defibrillation doses are determined by the type of defibrillator being used, either the standard monophasic device or one of the newer biphasic devices. For a monophasic defibrillator, the dose is 360 joules. If you're using a biphasic device, it's more complicated, unless you do not know the type of biphasic waveform device being used, in which case the dose is 200 joules. But if you do know, you will be expected to know the correct dose for each type. There are 2 types of biphasic waveforms, truncated and rectilinear. If you are using a biphasic defibrillator with a truncated waveform, the dose is 150 to 200 joules. For a rectilinear waveform, it is 120 joules. 2. When a patient is not responding to ACLS measures, recheck and confirm placement of the endotracheal tube using a confirmation device. Poor oxygenation is one reason medications may not be working. 3. The current recommendations for sodium bicarb in the arrest situation are restricted to the presence of any of the following: known pre-existing hyperkalemia or hypermagnesemia, sodium channel blocker toxicity, severe metabolic acidosis with adequate ventilation, a cyclic antidepressant or phenobarbital overdose, an overdose of a drug that responds to urine alkalinization, and a long arrest interval. The third major category of cases that presents a challenge to the emergency physician is substance abuse with complicating illnesses or injuries. By substance abuse, I mean street drugs such as heroin, cocaine, PCP, etc., the alcohols, ethanol, methanol, and ethylene glycol, over-the-counter drugs, and prescription drugs. There are several critical decision points in managing these patients. First is the decision to evaluate and treat him as you would any other patient. Many of us have an aversion to these patients. Some are uncomfortable interviewing and managing them, and a few look for a quick way to dump these cases on another service. And these are the very reasons you are likely to be confronted with one of these patients sometime during the exam. The examiner wants to know that you will act professionally, obtain an adequate history, perform a thorough physical exam, diagnose and treat all associated illnesses and injuries that are appropriate for emergency department management, and finally, assure an appropriate disposition for him. The second critical decision hinges on your ability and willingness to deal with a substance abuse patient in a manner that is appropriate for him. If he's obnoxious, will you become angry? If he says he wants to leave, will you let him? If he's uncooperative, will you simply note that fact on the chart and then abandon your intent to do a thorough H&P? Do not plan to write a complete history and physical after an initial interview and exam, since these patients are frequently unwilling, uncooperative, and unfriendly. A single interview is unlikely to disclose the total picture. Plan to make 2 or 3 separate visits in that room, each time obtaining a little more history and performing a more extensive exam. Substance abuse patients, for the most part, tend to become more comfortable and cooperative if they see you frequently during the time they are in the emergency department. Specific diagnostic tests and treatment can be going on in between these assessments. Here are some points in dealing with these patients that may help you deal with this difficult situation. 1. Accept the fact that you have to spend some time with this patient. You may also have to search for significant others in order to obtain necessary information to determine all the problems he has. 2. Never confront the patient with his unacceptable behavior. Instead, deal with what he is saying. If you respond to what he is saying, he will know that you are at least listening to him, and he is more likely to become cooperative. The third critical decision is determining the extent of the physical exam. A cursory exam will not do. Substance abusers can have a multitude of complicating illnesses and injuries, many of which can have subtle presentations. Always perform a complete physical exam in these patients. This is a rule to which there are no exceptions. A complete physical exam will uncover most of his medical problems. A good history and appropriate diagnostic studies will uncover any others. The fourth critical decision is determining what diagnostic tests to order. The most common error in clinical practice in this respect is an inadequate workup. I believe this is due to erroneous interpretation of the patient's affect and complaints. Here are some examples. An abrupt change in an alcoholic's behavior may be because he's a drunk, or it may be secondary to an expanding subdural hematoma. Weakness and malaise in a heroin addict are common complaints of a junkie, but they may also be symptoms of sepsis or an occult abscess. There is no standard battery of tests for these patients. In general, it's best to base diagnostic studies on historical and physical exam findings. The fifth and final critical decision is disposition of the patient. Do not let him sign out AMA, and do not discharge him if he has no place to go. Most of the substance abuse cases presented at this exam will require admission, since they are likely to have significant associated illnesses, injuries, or both. The fourth category of exam cases is poisoning and overdose. There are three critical points in these cases. Number one, consider a toxicologic emergency in the differential diagnosis of any patient with vague complaints or an altered sensorium. Specifically, there are 8 subgroups of patient types or presentations that are highly suspect. Children, ages 1 through 5. The elderly. The psychiatric or depressed patient. Young trauma victims, especially males in their late teens or early 20s. The patient exposed to a fire. The comatose patient. The young patient with a cardiac dysrhythmia. And the patient with metabolic acidosis of uncertain etiology. Number 2. Consider more than one diagnosis in these patients. Multiple drug ingestions are frequent. Associated injuries occur commonly. Metabolic derangements such as acid-base or electrolyte imbalance are possible complications, particularly in the OD patient who is also diabetic, and the alcoholic who just appears to be drunk. Number 3. Be very resourceful in determining what was ingested. Clues will be given to you if every historical source is pursued and a complete physical exam performed. Pay particular attention to the skin, breath odor, lung sounds, and cardiac rhythm. For example, diaphoresis is common in poisoning from organophosphates, salicylates, and sympathomimetics. Needle tracks point to a narcotic or cocaine overdose. Pressure sores indicate poisoning from barbiturates, carbon monoxide, or meprobamate. A fruity breath odor suggests ketoacidosis. An odor of silver polish or bitter almonds may be detected in poisoning from cyanide, but remember, only 50% of the population can detect this. A strong garlic or insecticide odor should suggest organophosphate poisoning. Non-cardiogenic pulmonary edema may be the clinical presentation of a narcotic or salicylate overdose. Cardiac dysrhythmias may indicate toxicity from one of the following: cyclic antidepressants, phenothiazines, carbon monoxide, cyanide, cocaine, digitalis, beta blockers, and chloral hydrate. Now let's go to the next category. The pediatric emergency is the fifth major category, with child abuse heading the list as the most frequently encountered case. Any child with a burn, fracture, or toxicologic presentation should be suspect. Other topics that merit review are these: pediatric arrest and trauma resuscitation, fluid resuscitation in the dehydrated child, asthma, seizures, near drowning, new onset diabetes, fever, meningitis, sepsis, and Reye syndrome. Congenital and hereditary disorders should also be kept in mind when dealing with the pediatric age group. Two of the ones we see more commonly in the emergency department are a slipped capital femoral epiphysis presenting as knee pain and the hemophiliac presenting with bleeding problems, often secondary to occult trauma. Critical decisions in managing pediatric emergencies emerge from situations such as these. 1. Aggressive airway support for severe respiratory distress or depression, since this is the leading cause of arrest in children. The critical decision is when to intubate. 2. Aggressive circulatory support in shock syndromes, since a sudden severe drop in blood pressure occurs more frequently in children than adults. The critical decisions here are which fluid to use, how much, and where to obtain venous access. And 3, correct medication doses, since too little or too much can make a crucial difference in resuscitative efforts. The critical decision is knowing which doses must be committed to memory. Remember the axiom we learned in training about LPs and meningitis? The axiom was this: if you're thinking about the possibility of doing a spinal tap, do it. We've all learned how true that statement is. Well, I have another axiom for you. This one concerns intubation and respiratory compromise in kids. If you're thinking the child might benefit from intubation, then do it. And remember the following when you intubate an infant or small child: do not hyperextend the neck. Place the child's head and neck in the sniffing position. The correct tube size is estimated based on the following formula: the age of the child plus 16 divided by 4. Use an uncuffed tube for children up to 7 or 8 years old. Don't worry if the correct sized laryngoscope blade is unavailable. In an emergency situation, one can usually intubate with a straight blade that is larger than what is indicated. Now, the opposite is true for the size of the endotracheal tube. If you're having trouble passing it, try a size smaller. Associated laryngeal edema can narrow the laryngotracheal opening. Fluid resuscitation in the treatment of the pediatric shock syndromes, including dehydration, is usually accomplished with Ringer's lactate or normal saline. Fluid boluses of 20 cc per kilogram can be given as needed to support shock. Children in hypovolemic shock from blood loss should be given blood if there is no clinical improvement following the first two boluses. Those with dehydration who do not respond well to two fluid boluses should be given a third 20 cc per kilogram fluid bolus, but it should be given more slowly, over 20 to 30 minutes. Remember to use a pediatric microdrip IV setup. Determining the site of venous access is another critical decision in the management of pediatric emergencies. The following guidelines may be helpful to you. If a child is dehydrated or in early shock, percutaneous peripheral venous cannulation is the procedure of choice. It is the safest, simplest, and most rapid method of obtaining venous access. Be sure to flush the catheter with at least 5 cc of saline so that medications may reach the central circulation. If peripheral venous cannulation is unsuccessful, central venous access via the femoral, internal jugular, axillary, subclavian, or external jugular may be attempted. If venous access is not obtained within a few minutes in a child who is in profound shock or cardiac arrest, intraosseous cannulation or a venous cutdown should be performed. In a child less than 6 years of age, intraosseous cannulation of the proximal tibia is the procedure of choice, whereas a saphenous cutdown is preferred for a child 6 years of age or older. A word of caution here. Time spent securing vascular access at the expense of airway management is a common mistake in the management of pediatric emergencies, and nowhere is it more costly. A significant number of children will respond to airway management alone. In addition, once the child has been intubated, this route may be used to administer epinephrine, atropine, lidocaine, and naloxone. Calculating pediatric doses, in my opinion, is a detriment to efficient emergency care, since time is of the essence in these situations. Unless you are a pediatric emergency physician, you do not see these cases often enough to readily remember multiple dosage schedules. Most of you now use wall charts, index cards, or a pocket reference in the emergency department where the doses are pre-calculated based on the child's age or weight. Since you won't have any of these tools available at the exam, let me give you a few of the critical medications and dosage schedules here. The most commonly observed rhythms in the pediatric patient with cardiac arrest are asystole and bradydysrhythmias. About 10 to 20% arrests in children are due to V-fib or pulseless V-tach. Remember that cardiac arrest in children is usually secondary to respiratory depression, so do three things early in the code. 1. Check for foreign body obstruction. 2. Intubate and ventilate with a high O2 concentration. And 3. Give naloxone 0.1 mg per kilogram IV push if there is any possibility that a narcotic was ingested. It is also important to note here that the 2005 ACLS guidelines state that if, despite adequate oxygenation or ventilation, or delivery of two rescue breaths in an unresponsive child with a heart rate less than 60 and signs of poor systemic perfusion, you should begin chest compressions. Why? Because bradycardia is a common terminal rhythm in infants and children. So don't wait for development of pulseless arrest to begin chest compressions. Essential medications commonly used in pediatric resuscitation are epinephrine, atropine, lidocaine, amiodarone, and dopamine. The dosages of these drugs must be committed to memory. Epi, atropine, and lidocaine may be given by the intravenous, intraosseous, or endotracheal route, but the intravenous and intraosseous routes are preferred. For atropine and lidocaine, the dosages for these three routes are the same, but epinephrine may require higher dosing, at least 2 to 2.5 times the peripheral IV dose if given endotracheally. Keep this in mind if epi doesn't seem to be working, and use the dosings for the 1 to 1,000 solution. In the arrest situation, epinephrine is given in a dose of 0.01 mg per kilogram of the 1 to 10,000 solution for the first dose. For subsequent dosing, you may repeat the initial dose or increase the concentration tenfold by administering 0.1 mg per kilogram of the 1 to 1,000 solution. However, for bradycardia, the dose of epinephrine is 0.01 mg per kilogram of the 1 to 10,000 solution for all doses. Atropine is indicated for a bradyasystolic arrest due to AV block. The dose is 0.02 mg per kilogram, and remember the minimum dose of atropine, regardless of weight, is 0.1 mg since bradycardia may worsen with a lower dose. Lidocaine may protect against refibrillation after successful defibrillation. It should also be considered in children with shock-resistant V-fib or pulseless V-tach. The dose is 1 mg per kilogram. A drip is prepared by adding 120 mg of lidocaine into 100 cc's D5W. 1 cc per kilogram per hour delivers 20 micrograms per kilogram per minute. Start at 1 to 2.5 cc's per hour. You may use lidocaine, but the AHA and ACLS Guidelines 2005 advocate the use of amiodarone if the dysrhythmia is resistant to defibrillation and epinephrine. So here's the way it would go. Defibrillation, CPR, epinephrine, shock, amiodarone, shock. The dose of amiodarone in this setting is 5 mg per kilogram, and it should be given rapidly IV push. Again, if the endotracheal route is used, the dose of atropine is doubled, but the dose of lidocaine and epinephrine is the same for IV and IO routes. Amiodarone and dopamine should not be given through the tracheal tube. If bradyasystolic arrest persists or recurs after the adequate epinephrine doses have been given, consider an epinephrine infusion. 0.1 to 0.2 micrograms per kilogram per minute, titrated to effect. If a bradyasystolic arrest persists or recurs after administration of adequate atropine doses have been given, consider a dopamine infusion. Prepare as follows. Multiply the child's weight in kilograms by 6 to determine the number of milligrams of dopamine. Add this amount to D5W to make 100 cc's. 1 cc per hour delivers 1 microgram per kilogram per minute. Titrate to effect starting at 5 micrograms per kilogram per minute, and do not exceed 20 micrograms per kilogram per minute. The sixth major category is acid-base disorders, particularly those complicated by electrolyte imbalance. Patients with an altered mental status, a vague clinical presentation, or a combination of symptoms suggesting involvement of multi-organ systems should be suspect. A careful history may uncover an underlying medical illness or a medication that has kindled the acid-base disorder. The basic challenge in these cases is determining the cause of the chemical derangement and then providing appropriate therapy. Here are some of the critical points you need to consider in making your assessment and management decisions. 1. Arterial blood gas analysis and serum electrolyte determinations should be ordered on all patients in whom the clinical diagnosis is unclear. 2. Accurate interpretation of these lab values, plus a good H&P, should lead you to the cause of the chemical imbalance. 3. Appropriate management means treating the cause when possible, as well as the acid-base and electrolyte imbalance. One of the greatest challenges you have is the patient with metabolic acidosis of unknown etiology. There are three parameters that can help sort out this problem. The anion gap, the serum chloride level, and the serum potassium level. The anion gap is calculated by subtracting the concentration of chloride and bicarb from the concentration of sodium. The normal gap is 18 to 16 milliequivalents per liter. Metabolic acidosis may be associated with a normal anion gap or a high anion gap. If the anion gap is normal, look at the serum chloride and potassium levels. The serum chloride level should be elevated. Now take a look at the serum potassium level. If it is low, that is, less than 3.5, consider the following causes: diarrhea, either acute or chronic, carbonic anhydrase inhibitors, such as acetazolamide, which is Diamox, and renal tubular acidosis. I doubt that you would be given a case of primary renal tubular acidosis, but you might be given one that is secondary to ingestion of peraldehyde, outdated tetracycline, or amphotericin B. Hypercalcemia can also be associated with renal tubular acidosis. All of these conditions are caused by impairment of tubular reabsorption of bicarbonate. The most common clinical presentation of renal tubular acidosis is chronic weakness and fatigue, which is secondary to the associated hypokalemia. If the anion gap is normal with metabolic acidosis, but the serum potassium is elevated, consider the following as possible causes: ammonium chloride toxicity. And remember that ammonium chloride is found in some of the antitussive, expectorant, and antihistamine prescription drugs. Chronic pyelonephritis, obstructive uropathy, and adrenal insufficiency. Now, if the anion gap is high, that is, greater than 16 milliequivalents per liter, consider the following causes: diabetic ketoacidosis, alcoholic ketoacidosis, lactic acidosis, salicylate toxicity, ingestion of methanol, ethylene glycol, isoniazid, iron or pyraldehyde, and renal failure, which is uremia. Note that pyraldehyde ingestion can produce metabolic acidosis associated with either a normal or high anion gap. Metabolic alkalosis is another challenging situation. You don't see it as often as metabolic acidosis, but when you do see it, determining the cause can be a challenge indeed. There are multiple causes of metabolic alkalosis with complex clinical pictures, but I don't believe you'll be given such a case at the oral exam. There are causes, however, that are simpler to diagnose, and one of them may very well appear on the exam. The serum chloride level can help you sort them out. I think the most common cause of hypochloremic metabolic alkalosis seen in the emergency department is secondary to the use of diuretics. A careful history will reveal this diagnosis. The second most common cause is vomiting. Some causes of metabolic alkalosis are associated with a high serum chloride level. These include the following: severe hypokalemia, usually less than 2.5, Cushing's syndrome, and licorice ingestion. Of the three, Cushing's syndrome is probably the one most difficult to diagnose. A common clinical presentation of the patient with Cushing's syndrome is the triad of fatigue, weakness, and depression. Significant historical findings are weight gain, menstrual irregularities, polyuria, and polydipsia. On physical exam, there may be mild hypertension, hirsutism, and acne, unexplained bruises, and of course, edema. The laboratory picture in the patient with Cushing's syndrome, in addition to the hyperchloremic metabolic alkalosis, includes the following: a mild leukocytosis with less than 20 lymphs and no eosinophils on the differential, and a normal or elevated serum glucose with glycosuria detected on urinalysis. Metabolic acid-base disorders are among the most difficult clinical problems to assess in the emergency department. Mapping out the possibilities in a methodical, systematic manner is the key to uncovering the source. The seventh major category is environmental emergencies. Included in this category are hypothermia, heat-related disorders such as heat stroke and heat exhaustion, carbon monoxide poisoning, and near drowning. Hypothermia is easy to diagnose if you think of it and if you use a rectal probe that is calibrated to accurately determine subnormal temperatures. Unfortunately, most hypothermic patients present with illnesses or injuries that tend to divert your attention. The critical point in these cases is to obtain an accurate temperature recording. If you suspect this diagnosis, be sure to request that the temperature be taken with a rectal probe. Heat-related disorders are usually straightforward, but an important point to consider is this: many heat disorders are triggered by one or more medications the patient is taking. Frequent offenders include drugs with anticholinergic properties, especially cyclic antidepressants and atropine, as well as phenothiazines and cocaine. The critical point in assessing patients with heat-related disorders is to determine what medications they've taken. If you are not sure whether a particular medication may have triggered the hyperthermia, check the PDR, consult with a hospital pharmacist, or if you have it in your ER, look at the package insert for more information. Drugs that have been known to precipitate a heat stroke include the following: anticholinergic agents such as antihistamines, atropine, scopolamine, and cogentin, phenothiazines, particularly thorazine, cyclic antidepressants, cocaine, diuretics, fencyclidine and ephedrine, beta blockers and calcium channel blockers, LSD, which is important to consider in the patient with apparent acute psychosis, and amphetamines, which are commonly used by dieters. You do not need to memorize these drugs for the oral exam. I listed them here in the event that you might be given a heat stroke patient on one of these medications. Your score would go up if you were able to tell the examiner that the heat stroke may have been precipitated by the medication. Carbon monoxide poisoning should be considered in all patients who have been exposed to a fire. Improperly vented heating systems are another source of exposure, particularly at the beginning of the heating season. A clue here is the presence of concurrent illness in other family members and pets. Exposure to gasoline fumes, either intentional or accidental, is yet another, and usually the most obvious cause of carbon monoxide poisoning. All of these patients typically present with headache, nausea, dizziness, and/or a behavioral change. Of all the environmental emergencies, the near-drowning victim is probably your greatest challenge. Critical points to remember are these. 1. Aggressive airway management with intubation and mechanical ventilation is indicated in the unconscious or obtunded patient. 2. Cervical spine injury should always be considered. Immobilize the C-spine and order a portable lateral C-spine film. Remember that all 7 cervical vertebrae and the C7-T1 interspace must be visualized. 3. Substance abuse or medical emergencies may have precipitated the event. Administer Narcan and glucose when an IV line has been established. Order appropriate lab studies and pursue historical sources that can provide you with the information you need. Always consider an MI as a possible cause of the drowning in the older adult patient and order an ECG. 4. Hypothermia and non-cardiogenic pulmonary edema are frequent complications. Ask the nurse to use a rectal probe in order to obtain an accurate core temperature. Aspiration may be confused with incipient pulmonary edema on clinical exam. Auscultation of the chest may reveal wheezing, rouse, or ronchi, and the patient may produce large amounts of frothy sputum. The chest X-ray may or may not be helpful. A diffuse alveolar or interstitial infiltrate may be seen with aspiration or edema. However, a segmental or lobar infiltrate, particularly on the right side, is diagnostic of aspiration pneumonia. The cornerstone of therapy for the patient with fluid aspiration or non-cardiogenic pulmonary edema is the same, and that is mechanical ventilation with the use of positive end expiratory pressure. Lasix is not likely to be effective since the pulmonary capillary wedge pressure in non-cardiogenic pulmonary edema is low. It should be noted here that pulmonary edema is more commonly associated with saltwater drowning. 5. Associated injuries are common in near-drowning victims, particularly skull fractures, but search for other injuries as well. Assess this patient as you would any major trauma victim. And 6, in patients with a history of prolonged submersion, renal failure, disseminated intravascular clotting, and cerebral edema may occur. Laboratory assessments and repeated physical exams are indicated. Vascular emergencies constitute the 8th major category of cases. Aneurysms, pulmonary emboli, and hypertensive emergencies are the cases most frequently encountered. Dissecting thoracic aneurysms and ruptured abdominal aortic aneurysms have one critical management point in common. Both of these catastrophic events are associated with abnormal blood pressures that require treatment. Thoracic dissections are commonly associated with an elevated blood pressure that should be lowered to prevent progressive dissection. The most frequently used drug regimen is propranolol in combination with nitroprusside. Following a test dose of 0.5 mg of propranolol IV, 1 mg of propranolol is administered every 5 minutes until the heart rate is between 60 and 80. Then an infusion of sodium nitroprusside is started and titrated to a systolic pressure of approximately 100 to 120 millimeters mercury. Single-agent therapy with IV labetalol is another option. Abdominal aortic ruptures, on the other hand, are associated with low blood pressures and are frequently accompanied by a syncopal episode. In these cases, shock treatment consists of IV fluids and blood transfusion. The diagnosis of pulmonary embolus poses a unique challenge to emergency physicians because signs and symptoms are nonspecific and clinical presentations are frequently vague and misleading. Critical points in patient evaluation are these. 1. Smaller emboli produce a clinical picture of predominantly pulmonary symptoms, most notably dyspnea, pleuritic chest pain, and cough. Tachycardia is also frequently present. Remember, too, that hyperventilation is a common clinical presentation with these patients. 2. Large or massive pulmonary emboli produce a clinical picture of predominantly cardiovascular symptoms, which may appear similar to those of a patient having an MI. Severe chest pain with shortness of breath and diaphoresis is not uncommon. Unlike the MI patient, however, onset of symptoms is usually abrupt rather than gradual. 3. A ventilation perfusion lung scan should be ordered for any patient with a suspected pulmonary embolism. In some hospitals, the spiral CT has been used in conjunction with an abnormal chest film to detect a PE. The major advantage of spiral CT over a VQ scan is that it can identify other pulmonary pathology. However, neither of these studies can accurately detect subsegmental defects. This picture may change in the future as spiral CT angiography evolves as a diagnostic modality. 4. If the lung scan or spiral CT is non-diagnostic, but the clinical picture is highly suggestive of pulmonary embolism, the patient needs further evaluation with either peripheral venous studies or CT angiography. Peripheral vascular studies are often done first because they are less invasive. If positive, they provide indirect evidence of a pulmonary embolus sufficient enough to initiate heparinization. If, however, these studies are negative or uncertain, an angiogram must be done. Angiography should also be done in those patients who are at high risk for bleeding complications from anticoagulation therapy and in those whom you anticipate thrombolytic therapy or surgical embolectomy. In other words, the unstable patient in whom you suspect a massive embolus. CT angiography is likely to replace pulmonary angiography, especially since CT images can be reconstructed to produce a resolution of 2 millimeters, which is smaller than the resolution of pulmonary angiography. Assessment of patients with hypertension revolves around 2 focal points, a clinical focus and a critical focus. The clinical focus is determining whether or not the patient's clinical presentation is the result of a hypertensive crisis. The critical focus is determining how quickly the blood pressure should be lowered. Consider the following in your evaluation of these patients. 1. A diastolic blood pressure of 130 or more is usually present in the urgent and emergent cases, although it can be less, particularly in toxemia of pregnancy. 2. More important than the absolute number is the presence or absence of signs and/or symptoms of end organ damage or dysfunction. 3. Hypertension that is associated with signs of end organ damage, such as encephalopathy, myocardial ischemia, or intracranial hemorrhage, is a hypertensive emergency. In these patients, the goal of therapy is to lower the blood pressure by 30% of their pretreatment levels over the first hour of therapy, and then admit them to the ICU or CCU. 4. Patients who have significant hypertension, that is, a diastolic blood pressure of 115 to 130 or more, without signs of end organ damage, are classified as urgent cases. In these patients, the goal is to lower their blood pressure more gradually, over a period of 24 to 48 hours. The 9th and last major category of cases is diabetic emergencies. Diabetic ketoacidosis, hyperosmolar non-ketotic hyperglycemia, and hypoglycemia are all cases we've managed with some frequency in the emergency department. What's important about these cases, in addition to their management, is the cause of the problem. The hypoglycemic patient should also be checked for any possible injuries sustained after losing consciousness. The most common cause of diabetic ketoacidosis is infection. Urinary tract infections and pneumonia are the most frequent precipitating infections. But any infection, even minor ones such as a cold or gastroenteritis, can trigger this metabolic derangement in the insulin-dependent diabetic. Other causes to consider are an acute MI, a CVA, trauma, pregnancy, hyperthyroidism, pancreatitis, steroid usage, emotional upset, and of course, omission of insulin. A careful history and physical exam will provide clues. If initial lab studies, ECG, and chest X-ray are unrevealing, methodically rule out the possible causes in the following manner. Order cardiac enzymes, a serum amylase, and a pregnancy test when appropriate. Consider a CT scan if the history and physical suggest the possibility of a CVA. Search for evidence of occult trauma. If hyperthyroidism is a possibility, clues to the diagnosis can be found on physical exam. For example, warm, moist, smooth skin, an enlarged thyroid gland, a wide pulse pressure, and brisk tendon reflexes. Thyroid studies can be ordered, but results are not likely to be available for several hours. A history of emotional instability should be sought if organic causes of DKA have been ruled out. This is a likely possibility if there is also a history of a recent emotional crisis. Diabetic ketoacidosis is usually precipitated rather suddenly, within a few hours to a few days, and occurs in the insulin-dependent diabetic. Non-ketotic hyperosmolar hyperglycemic coma, on the other hand, develops over a period of many days to several weeks and is seen in the non-insulin-dependent diabetic. These latter patients are taking an oral hypoglycemic agent or they are on a diet control program only. Some are not even aware of their diabetic condition. The majority of patients who present with hyperosmolar coma have chronic debilitating illnesses. Examples are the nursing home patient, the patient with chronic renal or cardiovascular disorder, and the patient with chronic dementia. A variety of drugs have been implicated as well. Thiazide diuretics and oral diazoxide are both well-recognized causes of non-ketotic hyperosmolar coma. Oral diazoxide, by the way, is not used as an antihypertensive agent, but as a hyperglycemic agent that is used in the management of hypoglycemia due to hyperinsulinism. Other drugs that can induce hyperosmolar coma are furosemide, steroids, phenytoin, cimetidine, beta and calcium channel blockers, immunosuppressive agents, and chlorpromazine. Again, you don't need to memorize these drugs. They are simply clues to the possible cause of hyperosmolar coma. As in diabetic ketoacidosis, infection is a common precipitating cause of hyperosmolar coma, with gram-negative pneumonia or sepsis being the most common cause. Other medical illnesses that have been implicated are myocardial infarction, CVA or subdural hematoma, GI bleeding, acute pyelonephritis, acute pancreatitis, uremia, and thrombophlebitis. Environmental exposure can also precipitate hyperosmolar coma. Included here are extensive burns, heat stroke, and hypothermia. The challenge of hypoglycemia lies in its recognition. Clinical presentations of hypoglycemia are variable, so strict adherence to the following principle is imperative. Any obtunded or comatose patient should be given an IV glucose bolus immediately after blood has been drawn for lab analysis. Acutely psychotic patients without a prior history of a mental disorder should also be suspect, particularly young adult males. Since hypoglycemia tends to occur suddenly, the patient may experience a syncopal episode. Significant injuries may result and should be sought. Meeting the challenge of difficult cases gives you an edge during this exam. Listen to this CD two or three times because these are the cases that require skill and expertise for successful management. There are others, of course, but I believe these nine represent the core case categories of the oral exam. This is the end of the first CD.